I think we figured it out.
We're going to open the Senate Education Committee today, May 18th, 2017. We're going to open a public hearing on 3358A. And with that, we'll have a short explanation. And Representative Wisnant, if you want to come on up, or anybody else you want to bring with you, you're welcome to bring. And here we go.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3358 establishes an advisory group on English language learner programs to advise the Oregon Department of Education on ORS 327.016 reporting requirements of ODE on ELL programs, which include amounts allocated from state school fund for ELL, and ORS 336.079, which is reporting requirements ODE on ELL programs, to ensure that progress aligns with statewide standards. The bill requires advisory groups to examine development and implementation of ELL programs to ensure students achieve biliteracy. It requires provisions or review to ensure rigor and satisfy requirements of high school diploma. Requires advisory group to advise ODE on professional development opportunities related to ELL and cultural responsiveness and review resources available to districts. The bill requires an advisory group to meet 4 times per year.
So with that, Representative Wisnant, it's nice to have you.
Mr. Chair and honorable committee members, thank you for having me here and having looking at our bill, House Bill Speaker Kotek, and my bill 3358. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnant, State Representative, House District 53. I'm really glad to bring you this bill. It came out of the House Education Committee and the floor in all unanimous votes. And the Speaker asked me to join her on this bill because I was involved with Representative Joe Gallegos the last 2015 passing House Bill 3499 and also a bill, House Bill 4057. But we're talking here about House Bill 3499, the English Language Learner Bill. The bill authorizes additional $12 million in addition to what comes out of the state school fund to improve our ELL programs. We were in, I'm on Ways and Means Subcommittee meeting with the good chair, and Cindy Hunt from Department of Education said that House Bill 3499 is historical in the state, in the this building, in this chamber, because it actually dedicates money but asks that you explain how you use that money, and even historical in the fact that the money can be taken away if we don't like the outcomes. So it is a great bill, and Speaker Kotek's suggestion here to have advisory group get together and monitor how they're doing, I think, is very important. The total amount of money spent on this is going to be significant with what is part of the school distribution formula and the additional $12 million. I think this is also historical in setting up a committee to look over how special money is spent to do this. So I'd be glad to answer questions. And in closing, I do urge you to pass House Bill 3358 to ensure success of our new efforts to improve English language learning programs.
Any questions for Representative Wisnant? Thank you very much. We have two witnesses, Morgan Allen and Parissa San Marie. I always do that wrong, but that's okay. You put too many vowels in your name. It's hard for me.
Okay, awesome. Hi, good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, my name is Parissa Chanrami. I'm the Policy and Advocacy Manager for Stanford Children. First off, we want to thank Speaker Kotek and Representative Wisnant for sponsoring this bill. We are an active member of the English Learners Advocates Coalition and partnered with the COSA, OSBA, and OEA, as well as other educators from the field in, you know, making sure that there was success in the passage of House Bill 3499, which passed 90-0 in 2015. And I remember recalling an article that had said that Governor Brown referred to it as a watershed moment for our state. And so after the bill was signed into law, then an 18-month long rulemaking process began in earnest. And the advocates, along with a lot of our allies and partners, had to work really hard to make sure that the rules were aligned with 3499. And so ensuring that the rules are implemented well, the laws implemented well as the other initiatives at the state and federal level that have to do with English Learners Plan and the Every Student Succeeds Act, having a continuing advisory group that's made up of diverse stakeholders. So you'll have educators, parents, we have students, as well as members from each of the ed associations on this advisory group. I think that'll be important to ensuring that implementation is successful, because we have our first set of districts that have been identified, 40 in total, that includes target and transformation districts that will be getting support from the Department of Ed. And we want to make sure that goes well so we can continue to improve outcomes for English learners, because right now only half of our English learners are graduating in 4 years. So we know there's a lot of work to do. We want to make sure that this advisory group continues and urge you to support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA. Would echo the comments of my colleague and would just add one thing. I think one of the most important things that we learned throughout this process was a really amazing statistic in K-12 education in Oregon, which is our students who exit English language learner programs and become proficient in English actually are, I believe, our highest subgroup of graduates. So there's something in the 80%, I can't remember the exact number, but when we teach our kids English, get them the supports they need early on, they exit out and transition to the non-ELL programs, they're our highest subgroup of graduation students. And so this bill, we believe, is going to go a long way from closing the gap that Parasa referenced. You know, about half of the people who are still identified as ELLs are graduating on time. But we also have this other group and this huge opportunity to drive up our graduation rate, get kids proficient in English, and really make a gigantic difference in how our kids are coming out of high school. So we would urge your support.
Any questions for anyone on this panel? Seeing none, thank you both. That concludes the people who were to testify on 3358. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3358. We will put it up in the next few days or weeks for a work session. So it will be on tap. We will now keep in the habit of working with Representative Wisnett. We'll open a public hearing on 3288 and have our staff read a short summary.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3288 requires each public institution of higher education to submit a report to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means as part of the institution's budget presentation during each odd-numbered year regular legislative session. The bill specifies that each report must identify the legislative mandates imposed on the institution, the impact of legislative mandates on the cost of higher education, causes of the increase in administrative positions occurring at the institution, and actions taken at the institution to monitor and control cost drivers. The bill requires institutions to submit their first report in 2019. The A2 amendment replaces the statutory provisions of the measure. It requires public universities to submit a concise annual narrative report identifying legislative mandates and the impact of those mandates on costs. It requires universities to identify the causes of increases in administrative positions and the actions taken to monitor and control cost drivers. Requires universities to submit their first report on legislative mandates during the 2019 legislative session. The A3 amendment amends the legislative declaration.
Okay. Thank you for being here, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all the committee members. I've asked Chair Daugherty in the House to make me an honorary member. Could I request the same thing here since I seem to be up here?
Yeah, getting close. We have one more bill. Did you have anything to do with a bill on civics?
Yes, sir. That's,
okay.
That's,
we'll work that one next. So.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Chair and honorable committee members, for the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. A primary issue for me during my legislative career has been to reduce the cost of higher education and thus increase access. Another priority has been legislative goal is transparency and accountability. House Bill 3288 is a common-sense legislative approach that supports these legislative goals. It will give Oregonians a better understanding of how their tax dollars and personal dollars are being spent at our four-year universities. Administrative costs as a cost driver have become a serious problem in American universities and colleges and is a major cost driver to the rising cost of tuition. A recent study at by the New England Center for Investigative Reporting and American Institutes for Research found that the number of non-academic administrative and professional employees at colleges and universities have doubled over the past 25 years. It came from the Huffington Post. U.S. Department of Education determined that administrators at universities have increased by 60% from 1993 to 2009, 10 times the growth rate of tenured faculty. A 2010 University of Arkansas study revealed that from 1993 to 2007, spending on administrative increased at a rate of at twice the rate of spending on research and teaching at our 198 top universities. House Bill 3288 will require each university, public university, and community colleges in Oregon to submit the information concerning administrative staff. As Lisa read to you, there's been some amendments. I agreed to an amendment that will require only the seven public universities to make this report. And we've also changed it from a report to make it a narrative report, so it's not lessens the work on the universities. Also, there's been an amendment to be sure that my report requires the universities to talk about how many bills and legislation by this body caused them to add administrative staff. So it's a fair report, and we'll take our licks at the same time. But I do urge, I think it's a good report. I have, as far as I know, all the amendments have satisfied all the opponents that there should not be any opposition. I would urge your aye vote on this narrative report so we can have some information how we're affecting, this body's affecting tuition costs, and how administrative services is also affecting it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Any questions for Representative Wisnett? Seeing none. And it appears that there are no people who want to speak against your bill. So enough amendments have been obviously added to it. So with that, we'll say thank you, and we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3288. Thank you very much. And we're going to move it to the counselor to have a...
You don't need comments on the 2219.
You can stay there if you want. So we'll move that to a work session in the future. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2219. There were some amendments to this bill. We are not going to entertain the one amendment that adds something else to it because I have promised a particular representative that other things we add to it will not hurt it, and I didn't want that to be affected. So we are, and
I appreciate
concern.
That, Mr. Chair.
But we do have a conforming amendment, so we'll hear from our administrator to explain that.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, House Bill 2219 encourages school districts and public charter schools to offer sufficient courses in civics to ensure those electing to receive instruction do receive it. The bill takes effect July 1st, 2018. The A4 amendment resolves a conflict with House Bill 2229 and requires that if House Bill 2229 is enacted, House Bill 2219 will take effect for the 2018-19 school year.
Okay. So with that, I'll entertain a motion. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move the A4 amendment dated 5/5/17 to House Bill 2219.
Senator Lithicum moves the -4, the A4 amendment dated 5/5/17. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So moved. Senator Lithicum.
Chair Roblin, I move House Bill 2219 as recently amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As Senator Lithicum has moved Senate Bill 2219 as recently amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, is there any discussion? Yes.
Chair, I just want to say that I do like the A3 amendments a lot.
So. I know. And I do appreciate that, too. Is there any opposition to this motion? Seeing none, the bill is passed. Is there anyone who wants to carry this bill? If not, I will carry it. So I guess that's mine. Thank you.
If I can help the committee anytime,
okay.
Let me know.
Thank you. So now we're back on track. Doherty is here. So now we'll go through the Doherty bills. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3318. We'll have a short explanation. Representative Doherty, can come on up.
If,
oh, 3318. I'm sorry. It's Lou.
I had it
wrong. And
it's the nose.
Yeah. I think you cut. Didn't you say you were Irish too?
Yes.
Can I go join in?
Among other things.
Can I join in?
Yes, please do. And Senator Gelser will come down.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3318 requires school districts to conduct a functional behavioral analysis and develop a behavior intervention plan for every student who has an individualized education plan or places other students or staff at risk of serious bodily harm because of behavior. The bill requires functional behavioral analysis to take place within 60 calendar days of the student putting others in imminent harm. It allows behavior intervention plans to have input from the service provider in development, review, or revision. It allows behavior intervention plans to inform service providers about relevant behavior. Requires service providers to be informed of any portions of behavior intervention plan that are relevant and any training opportunities for the service providers. It requires notifications to members of an IEP team or 504 plan team regarding changes to the behavior intervention plan. Defines behavior intervention plan, 504 plan, functional behavioral plan, service provider, and serious bodily injury. It becomes effective July 1st, 2017 and declares an emergency. The A3 amendment removes the emergency clause, alters definitions of behavior intervention plan, changes functional behavioral analysis to functional behavioral assessment, requires school districts to conduct functional behavioral assessments and develop, review, or revise intervention plans within 60 days of an incident in which a student causes serious bodily injury, requires that behavior intervention plans appropriately address students' needs, eliminates requirement that school districts notify members of the IEP program team or the team that created the 504 plan of changes to the behavior intervention plan. Takes effect July 1st, 2018.
Okay. I don't know if you need to testify now, but you're welcome.
I was going to say, I didn't need to say anything. Hello. I'm State Senator Lou Frederick from District 22. That's North and Northeast Portland. And I thank you, Chair Roblin, and the rest of the committee. This is a very simple bill in many ways. It's just a safety bill. It's trying to make sure that students and are safe, staff is safe, all the students in a classroom are also safe, and we have a plan to deal with it. That's the basis of this particular proposal. We do not, at this point, have that kind of a process directly in place, and we want to put it in place. It's not a not much more difficult than that, I don't think. Am I missing anything?
Of course not.
We need to know when a child needs help, and we need to make sure that child is safe and is not causing problems for everyone else around them. It's difficult. There are times when that's a real problem. But this is an attempt to try to deal with those particular issues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, I am your committee colleague and State Senator Sarah Gelser from Corvallis in Albany. I just really wanted to offer my deep thanks to Soren Metz of the Oregon School Employees Association. This has been an issue that people have wrestled with for a really long time, and it's frankly been one that's been difficult for me because the frame of this conversation has frankly been very, in the past, very negative about students and very stigmatizing about students that have behavioral needs that are going unmet in school. Soren has done an extraordinary job of really trying to get to the root of what this problem is when a child is exhibiting a behavior, every behavior is a form of communication. What is it that student is communicating, and how do we meet the need that is triggering that behavior? One of the things that's interesting about House Bill 3318 is a lot of it really is kind of required by federal law. If you have a student that has significant behavior issues, you are supposed to do a functional behavioral analysis or assessment. Your FBA, you're supposed to have a BIP, a behavior intervention plan. Everybody is supposed to be trained on it. It's supposed to be followed on it. The federal law says you can't expel a student or suspend a student for their behavior if there is a behavior plan that is not being followed, and that if they have recurrent behaviors, also if you have not done an appropriate functional behavior analysis. So I have complete trust in Soren, and if Soren comes and says these are the amendments that we need, then I wholly support her in that. I do believe that we'll be back to talk about this. Waiting 60 days after we know that there's a problem to complete an assessment is a long time for the student to wait. It's a long time for the teacher to wait. It's a lot of lost learning for the student. It's a lot of lost learning for the other students in the class, especially when it's something that is already required by federal law. The other thing that I hope that we can come back and talk about later is that the bill as it's written, and I understand we make compromises, and again, I support this in the form that Soren wants. I'm giving her some backup because she's made a lot of compromises, and so she needs to get credit for that. But the bill, as it's written, only applies to students with disabilities on IEPs and 504 plans. Contrary to popular belief, it is not just children with disabilities that struggle with behavior or communicate issues that they are having through behaviors. And I would feel more comfortable if it applied to all students. You shouldn't have to be in special education or have a 504 plan to be safe in the classroom, and for your teachers and educational assistants to know that you're going to be safe in the classroom. And finally, the bill and the amendment, and again, this is really great work on Soren's part, working to negotiate with the stakeholders. I think it's just common sense that classified staff that are working directly with students on a day-to-day basis have meaningful input into both an IEP and a functional behavioral assessment. They actually are already guaranteed that by federal law. That unfortunately is not the practice on a regular basis. And there are a whole variety of ways that these staff are kept out of these meetings. These staff know these kids better than anyone else. These staff are the ones that are held accountable for managing the kids' behavior. And when kids' behavior is blowing out, because a behavior plan isn't followed or isn't appropriate to the needs of the kid, and the kid is blowing out in a way that someone gets hurt, the people that are getting hurt are the classified staff. The classified staff have the knowledge and they have the most at stake. They should always be welcome to the table to talk about how to plan for the students. So those are things that I wish that we could do more. What we have is this, which is a great step forward. And again, I have been here for a while now. It's funny how time goes fast. I have rarely been as impressed and inspired by the work of a person as I have Soren. And she's just really... just has been a tremendous asset to kids and to employees, and taken something that's been divisive in the past and really helped us see how it impacts everyone. So everyone needs to give a high five to Soren, because she's really awesome and is kind of my hero.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
In this package, we see a lot of details about school districts and the student himself, him or herself, the service providers and program teams. I don't see any reference to including parents or guardians in this assessment. Are you assuming that's incorporated in the 504 as it is, and therefore not referring to it here?
May I?
Yes.
Chair Roblin, Senator Linthicum, the parents are a required participant in an IEP plan or a 504 plan. Technically, the federal law says any person that has knowledge of the student is eligible to attend the meeting, and any person that has knowledge of the student and is a party to the meeting is able to invite anybody that they want. The reason that this is called out is that too often, for whatever reason, classified staff who know these kids, who oftentimes are even their one-on-one assistants, are not being allowed into the meeting to plan for these students in an appropriate way.
Thank you.
Thank you. And along that same line, and part of the problem is oftentimes the student is not there for the whole plan because they have other issues, and the person who takes care of them is with them. So it is a catch-22 that we need to resolve. So thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, we're going to invite up Jason Cox, the infamous now Soren Metzger, who everybody has heard about, but didn't want to hold him off long so they'd actually know who that was, and Jared Mason Gear. And whoever wants to start can.
Okay, do I just go whatever? Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Jason Cox. I'm a communication specialist for the Oregon School Employees Association. As you know, we represent 21,000 members across the state, and I've had the opportunity to talk with dozens of them who work directly with students and have been injured on the job. And the most consistent theme I hear is how much they love their students and how responsible they feel for their safety and as well as the safety of their coworkers. I'm sure you can understand how difficult it is for our members to continue taking time off from their jobs to travel to Salem to testify in person. So thank you for allowing me to share a handful of stories on their behalf. Several have also submitted testimony on OLIS, so I hope you take the opportunity to check that out. Kristen Croft from Beaverton told me that she has learned to accept having objects thrown at her, being hit, kicked, bitten, scratched, and urinated on. One day when she was helping a student into a bus harness, he headbutted her in the face. As a result, she suffered a concussion and had bruised nerves at the base of her brain that would cause her limbs to flail uncontrollably in her sleep. This happened several years ago, but this is a phenomenon she still wakes up to sometimes. Kathy Forbes from Tillamook shared with me that she suffered neck and shoulder injuries for being pushed, hit, kicked, and hair pulled by her students. And in fact, she couldn't be here today because she is in physical therapy. Training on how to best help those students isn't consistently given. And she often isn't told about the behavioral patterns of her own students who, as Senator Gelser mentioned, are often working closest with them. And all she's looking for is to have the necessary knowledge and the training to give her students the best education possible. Gloria Lundin, who's an instructional assistant in Dallas, said that the stress and the physical impacts of the job lead to higher turnover and absenteeism, which for students that rely on that on those educational assistants who they know so well, there couldn't be a worse thing for them than switching over assistants. And the assistants are often asked, what could you have done to stop this? So, and I think that's really kind of what this bill gets at. You understand at this point, I think, the details of what this will do. What we're asking is that that records accurately reflect a student's history and that their staff are properly equipped and trained to help students reach their potential while ensuring everyone's safety in the process. Every day our members take care of Oregon's children, and they need their legislators to take care of them in return. House Bill 3318A is a tool to do just that. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. I'm Soren Metzger, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon School Employees Association in support of House Bill 3318. You've heard a lot about what the bill actually does, and I just want all of you to know that this is a major priority for the Oregon School Employees Association, and we're going to do everything that we possibly can. At the local district levels, we're encouraging our folks to get involved with the safety committees. At the statewide level, we're working with all of you, and we've brought a legislation forward. We're also working with state agencies on some rule changes, and we're even lobbying at the national level for more IDEA funding. We are definitely committed to this issue. I also would really like to thank everyone on the House side. Senator Doherty, Representative Doherty, Representative Hack, Representative Post. We've a number of folks on the House side and then also on the Senate side. So Senator Gelser, Chair Roblin, thank you all very much. Also, there's been a number of stakeholders in this involved in this conversation, in this process, including OEA, AFT Oregon, the really smart people at the Oregon Department of Education, COSA, the disability rights community. They know so much. FACT, Disability Rights Oregon, and I really, really enjoyed working with them on this issue. That being said, this is not a silver bullet. This is a little piece, a little step in the right direction, and like the senator said, I hope that this work continues in the form of either a work group or a task force. This conversations need to continue. That being said, we did have an amendment drafted. Hannah, if you're watching, you are great. The turnaround was phenomenal. I love her, just so you know. I don't think I need to go through the details of the amendment. I can say why if anyone is interested. But I would also just like you all to know that I did submit some additional information on OLIS. I know that sometimes when we talk about special education and IEPs, that can be somewhat confusing. So there is a sample, the Oregon Standard Individualized Education Program on OLIS that you can pull up for your own records. I can go through that with you just in terms of special factors and where the functional behavioral assessment and behavioral intervention plan, if they were being completed, where they would be as a part of the IEP, and then specifically where there are supposed to be training information on trainings detailed in the IEP, specifically under the program modification supports for school personnel. You're going to hear that this is a process that's already in place. It's going to cost a lot of money. We shouldn't have to do this. I just want you to know that I'm not the brilliant person who came up with this idea. I came up with a functional behavioral assessment and the behavioral intervention plan is from doing a lot of research on this subject, and have also provided another document that's called Writing High Quality IEPs Best Practices and Supporting Guidance. Like I said, there's a lot of really smart people at the Oregon Department of Education, and they've developed these resources, and that's also on OLIS, and you'll see on page 2 where it talks about special factors and behavior. It specifically calls out that the IDEA strongly supports the notion that IEP teams should proactively consider and implement BIPs, which at this point you all know are behavioral intervention plans, based on functions of the student's behavior. So my understanding is these are more or less suggestions, they're not requirements. And this bill, in my opinion, would make it a requirement and then also say that these folks who are working with students must be a part of the conversation. And I don't think that that is such a strange request. We, you know, currently OARs specifically say that our folks should already be a part our folks can be invited to the IEP planning meetings. I recognize that it's difficult for districts to allow our folks to actually do that. It also, OARs specifically say that our folks should have access to this. However, working with the Oregon Department of Education, they cannot specifically tell me if service providers did include the instructional and educational assistants working directly with the students, which is why we want that clarified in this bill. So that being said, there's just a couple more things that I'd like you to keep in mind in terms of the costs. You know, this is going to be a huge cost for districts. I want you to know that I've been working with Oregon OSHA and was recently made aware that there are more workers' compensation claims coming from school employees than there are in the non-residential construction industry. So when we're talking about costs, I want us to keep in mind that there's a huge cost to not doing something, to not providing the necessary information, supports, and trainings to our folks who are working in special education. And so please keep that in mind, because when these folks are out on a workers' compensation claims, it's an expense to the district to hire subs, to find subs, to train them, and to recruit good people who are willing to do this work. So please keep those things in mind as you consider the bill. And then I'll go ahead and are there any? Oh, I'll maybe wait to the end. Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jared Mason Gear with the Oregon Education Association, representing 44,000 educators across Oregon, including a number of education service professionals or classified employees, in addition to the classroom teachers that we represent. We hear and see all the time the types of injuries that Jason was discussing amongst our members. This is an incredibly serious issue. One, I think it's important to note, that is widespread well beyond just the special education realm. This is something that we see in general education classrooms at just the same rate, and that's really important to recognize also. This isn't just a special education issue. When this bill was introduced, it was a bit of a complex bill for us, because we do see these kinds of injuries. We do believe that this is one of the most important and pressing issues facing educators in the classroom. At the same time, our classroom instructors and certified special ed staff wrestle also with a lot of difficulty around managing the workflow with IEPs and other paperwork that comes with the work. And so we were somewhat wary of anything that could complicate that work any further. And OSEA was very diligent in working through with us some of the concerns we had on the House side, and then in the amendments that you see before you today. So we do believe that 3318 at this point is an important bill that should move forward this session, and please support it. I would say, I think that this work needs to continue. I think that we do need to form a work group to continue both figuring out what are some ways we can get at this, specifically in the SPED realm, and then also in general education as well, because it's something that's not going away. I think also important to note that staffing is a real issue and a real contributor to this problem, and the lack of well-trained adults in our schools, and that we do need to fund education at a level that will allow us to hire more people, and that was something that is going to have to happen if we're actually going to get at these problems in a thorough way. So encourage your support, but also encourage you to continue the conversations and look for other ways that you can help address these problems as well. Thank you.
Any questions for this group? Yes, Senator Gelser.
I just wanted to add something for the record. It jumped out, and not to detract from the bill, but in Oregon, mechanical restraint is not legal. It's always prohibited. So nobody should be putting a child in a harness.
Thank you.
Do you want to say anything about Soren?
Have I mentioned that I think she's done a great job? Okay. And I concur with her assessment of Hannah's great work as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to stop this hearing for a second because we have a plethora of legislators who have assembled on a particular bill, and I'd like to get their testimony about that bill so they can get to their work, and then we'll finish this one up. So the we're going to open at the same time a public hearing on House Bill 2701, and we'll invite the plethora of legislators to come on up if they would like. You're welcome to come on up.
Thank you.
With that, we'll hear a short explanation of this bill, and then we'll let the plethora talk.
The plethora. Plethora. Speak.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2701 eliminates probationary status designation for licensed private career schools and agents. It changes terminology in statute from place a licensee on probation to issue a notice for corrective action. The A5 amendment requires HEC to notify licensees and grant a contested case hearing under ORS 183.310 sub 2 prior to any further action if HEC determines that a notice of correction notice of corrective action should be issued, declares an emergency effective on passage. The A6 amendment adds a requirement that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission notify the career school that it is the subject of the notification upon receiving a written complaint or deciding to proceed to an investigation. It requires HEC to engage with the school and students during the course of an investigation.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Senator Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Margaret Doherty. I'm the state representative from House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And the bill that is being brought before you, it's like to me kind of a hydra. All of a sudden, all of these things start coming out of this bill, but it's actually a very simple bill. When we brought it up on the House side, and it had been brought to my attention by somebody I had worked with years ago, that there didn't seem to be a smooth process to go through and file complaints for two-year career colleges, and that the career colleges were suffering in the sense we're going to be talking about this in a minute, that that they didn't really get to have their day in court to go through and say, well, this is what the person said, but I would like the opportunity to be able to respond and so on. And so from that came House Bill 2701. We heard it on the House side. Representative Kennemer and myself had actually put in a Dash 5 amendment, which is the one that's in front of you. And if we look at the Dash 5 amendments and as opposed to the Dash 6, and I appreciate, first of all, meeting with HEC, and I appreciate HEC going through and working with us on this bill, trying to get some sort of a process to make sure that people have their say when their schools are in question. And so if you look at the Dash 5s on the A and Gross, it's actually a much simpler bill. What it does is it goes through, and this is on line 17, it goes, when notice of suspension or revocation is issued, and then Dash 5 adds, or the commission determines that a notice of correction action should be issued, the licensee shall be notified and upon request shall be granted a contested case hearing under ORS 183.310, and then we added prior to any further action by the commission. So that basically is a Dash 5. It just gives a process where if a complaint has been filed, I, as the owner of the school, has an opportunity to go through and explain my way. And so it's much simpler. The Dash 6s were a little simpler, but on line 13 of the proposed amendment that you have in the Dash 6, it said, when conducting an investigation under this section, the commission shall engage with both career, and we're not quite sure what engage really means. The Dash 5 language was much simpler. It's just, this happens, you have a hearing, and you go from there. And so with this, we are encouraging the language with the Dash 5s, and then also encouraging a work session on this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Janelle Bynum. I represent House District 51, which includes East Portland, Happy Valley,
North Clackamas, Damascus, Gresham, and Boring. I'm here to advocate from a small business perspective. As you know, these private colleges operate in two spaces, one in the education space and one in the business space. And I wanted to just bring a couple of items to light here. Number one, the terminology that we use or that we authorize the HEC to use has an impact on a business's ability to get capital. And so when you use terms like probation, that can trigger other things from a business side to happen. That means they could lose their accreditation or they could go into some sort of never land with that. They could lose their lease. Loans can be called. So we as a legislature or as a rulemaking body don't necessarily know what's in all of the business leases and languages and accreditation language. So we have to be very, very, very careful about allowing the HEC to use terms like probation. The other thing I wanted to mention was that when a student or any customer has a complaint, that business deserves due process. And we're not using that term due process here in the bill, but that is essentially what it is. And I firmly believe that every Oregonian, including a business in Oregon, deserves due process. You deserve to have a customer make a complaint, and you deserve as a business owner to be able to respond to that complaint without having to go around and around in circles and have a state agency deflect your questions and not have to answer them. So I guess I'll kind of close it with that. I am supportive as well of the Dash 5 amendments, and I agree that they allow us to address this issue of fairness. But I stepped in not as a sponsor on the bill, but really as someone who firmly believes in the state's interest in making sure that businesses have a fair shot to address any issues that a customer might bring forth towards them. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, Clackamas County. Appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I appreciate your patience. And I think this is an important bill, and I appreciate Representative Bynum being here. She serves on the House committee that heard this, and it was there that they determined a little further work was needed, and that's what the Dash 5 amendments are all about. And I guess I would add a little clarification. Representative said a day in court, sort of, and I want to be very clear, we're talking about a case hearing, and that is the language in the amendment. So,
I was using that metaphorically.
And I think she was, but I want to be sure because there had been some confusion at some point about that, and I want to be very sure we were on the record. And I think if there are any questions, we'd be happy to respond.
Any questions for this group?
One more point I wanted to make. Thank you again for allowing me to make this last point. When a person is running a business like a school, and the negative publicity from an unsubstantiated complaint comes in, and that business loses customers or loses students, that represents potentially that business owner's retirement. That could represent their life savings. And I don't think that this is anything that we should play with. We want to be very serious about the viability of our private career schools, but we also want to make sure that people who enter into business have a fair shot of keeping their retirement alive. And so I think in this case that we're actually responding to, the business owner essentially lost the value of their school. And when you're on probation and you lose your accreditation, maybe your school was valued at, let's say, $1 million before. After this is all over and you lose your students, your business is valued at zero. And that's unnecessary if a person has a fair day in court.
Metaphorically. I just wanted to ask a couple questions. Do you believe that your A5 put it, these career schools in the same place as a four-year institution or four-year private school with respect to the process?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, it puts it in much, it gets it closer to where the four-year private colleges are, because there was a different standard, and the two-year colleges didn't have the same sort of, again, due process, not in the legal sense, but being able to explain and so on as the four-year institutions, private colleges,
and
career colleges.
In the A6s, you were part of that, the conversation we were having about that one. In trying to make sure that they get noticed, they know what's happening, and whatever, without having it a day in court, but
right.
Making sure that everybody knows what's going on and where it's coming, where do you think it falls short?
Well, I think with the A6 is what it is. It's the purpose is the same way, but the verbiage that is written, and this comes from their rule, when you go through and said, you know, that you will have a meeting and so on and so forth, as opposed to the commission shall engage with both the career school and the whatever. I think the terminology of the commission shall engage is very vague. Is engaging a phone call? Is engaging a letter? Is engaging actually having a hearing with them? That was the only problem that I had with the A6s. I did appreciate meeting with Heck and coming up with that, but the A5s are, I think, simpler, clearer, and more to the point.
Okay. We'll have the rest of the hearing. We'll hear from everybody else, and then we'll try to make a decision. And at some point in the near future, because we don't have long,
we'll
start working on work sessions and that, depending on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. Any other questions for this group? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so now we're going to go back to House Bill 3318, which we did not close, so we just keep going. So Whitney Fitzgerald, Brenda King, and Bob Jonda. Come on up. And thank you for being here and your patience to let those other people get back to their work.
Thank you for allowing us to be here. First of all, I just want to say thank you for allowing me to speak today. House Bill 3318A is important because educators.
And we are really interested in knowing who you are.
Oh, I'm Whitney Fitzgerald.
Thank you, Whitney.
Okay. So this bill is important because educators working with these students should not be injured on the job. And passing this bill would ensure that educators will have the proper information to safely work with the students. And I have some examples. I was working with a student, trying to redirect a student from leaving the classroom. He was a male, 5'7", 160 pounds. He was shoving his body into me, trying to pass by, and I put my arms up to guide him back to class, and he went down and bit my arm, leaving welts and bruises for weeks, and it was extremely sore. I was attempting to calm an upset student, and this took place inside of our classroom bathroom. He's about 5'9", 200 pounds. He picked up a Lysol spray can from about 3 feet away and sprayed me in the eyes with it. My eyes were red, burning, and swollen, blurry vision. I was able to flush my eyes fairly quickly, and I recovered, so all is well. But, you know, have we have the proper information, then maybe these things could be avoided. So thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Brenda King, and I am sharing a story on behalf of a coworker, Heather M. She was working with a male student who was approximately 5'7", 170 pounds. The student became upset, and I am going to use this lanyard just to give you a better visual. This student, mind you, is a male, 5'7", 170 pounds, became upset. Heather had her lanyard on. He pulled the lanyard, pulling her neck down. She immediately grabbed the lanyard above his hands to protect herself. She was in this position for a few seconds. At the moment that he pulled on that lanyard and pulled her down, she had immediate pain in her neck. Heather was unable to break away with this student holding her down with her lanyard. It pains me to share this type of story that our employees are going through. While Heather was held in that position, the student was biting on her badge. That badge could have been her arm, could have been a part on her body. To this day, Heather continues to feel pain in her neck. She enjoys her job. She enjoys working with the students. However, she is still continuing to feel the pain in her neck due to the injury that she incurred working with the student. I urge you to please, please consider passing this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bob?
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you very much for an opportunity to testify today. I bring to you the perspective of families and students who may be affected by this bill. Our organization provides legal assistance to individuals and families in the school setting, and probably most of our work in that area has to do with students who've been excluded from school due to behavioral problems or conditions at school that arise around behavioral problems. We are supporting House Bill 3318 because we think it is a step in the right direction. We are extremely pleased that so many good people and thoughtful people have come together to continue to work on these issues. We don't think this bill gets us to nirvana on the issue, but it does move the ball down the field. I just like to make one point for the record, is that there are some standards set out in the bill that parallel, in a way, standards in the special education laws and in the 504 laws. They're not the same. As you know, state law cannot set a lower standard than federal law, and in some instances, the standards that are set in this bill are actually lower than the federal law. So for just one example, the Dash 3 amendments say that the that moving toward a functional behavioral analysis is triggered by an actual physical injury or violent action in the school, whereas we would hope that putting a plan in place is going to happen before that, because that's what we all want to do. We want to keep staff, we want to keep students and everyone safe, and that's our goal here. So, but we do think that the bill does move in the right direction, and we support it.
Thank you. Any questions? I would guess that my feeling would be I agree with you. I think that the standard is that we should have the plan going in. If the student has never exhibited behaviors which would have led to that, I think this is a good fail-safe to say if something happens, you probably better have that meeting. So I think there are reasons and times when this would be in place to make sure that districts know, okay, now there's no excuse. Previously there was no problem, we probably didn't need something, or we had a cursory thing in place. But once somebody actually has an issue come up, you better get it going very quickly. But I totally agree with you that there are standards and we have to follow that. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that's what I was trying to get at earlier, is that a lot of what's being asked for
is already there.
Is required, but it's not, and we do that a lot, unfortunately, especially around special education. But even in the best practice document that Soren updated, you know, that you know, ODE in this, you know, confirms districts are required to address behavior that impedes the student's learning or the learning of others, and that impeding learning is a much lower standard than causing actual injury to someone.
Yeah, we agree. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for the correction.
Thank you.
And to close this hearing with our last testimony, Morgan Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Morgan Allen here on behalf of COSA. And I think it's good for everyone to get in front of a bill or get on the tracks in front of a bill at least once every session where you have some respectful disagreements with people that you enjoy working with and respect. And you agree with the problems they're raising and you agree with the concerns and you also agree that we need to do something about it. So I'm going to make my comments brief. Because we represent special education directors and other administrators that work with the teachers and support staff and educational assistants that deal with these students. And ultimately, our folks are responsible for the outcomes for those students. And I think you've heard a little bit. There's very little with what has been said today that I would disagree with or I think that any of our folks would disagree with, except for a couple of things. I'm not sure this bill, for the examples, the kicking and scratching and a lot of the other examples that we're hearing, I don't think this bill would do very much, if anything, to deal with those situations. The way it's written, as has been correctly pointed out, talks about functional behavior analysis. So our folks do have some concerns with some of the technical aspects of it, and I think this has been hinted at. It sort of takes a bunch of current state and federal rules around IDEA, IEPs, 504s, and kind of throws them into a blender and mixes them up and kind of makes a sort of a new path for a very narrow group of students, students with IEPs and students with 504 plans. And I think that was done to sort of avoid creating a fiscal impact, because this will probably not, in fact, impact very many students, at least from the way I read it. And, you know, one of the things that was discussed is my understanding is currently a functional behavior analysis. Those are meant to be applied when students have behaviors that interfere with their access to education. And so if a student has discipline problems or behavior problems or other activities that are disruptive and they have special education needs, it's required to do a functional behavior analysis to determine if in fact, that disability is part of the reason they're acting out. And we're kind of flipping the script here. The FBAs are about student behaviors and working to make sure students have access to school. And we're flipping it to triggering an FBA when a staff person, and I know the amendments may change this and now may change, get back, there's been different versions, when a staff person is either threatened or actually seriously injured would trigger an FBA. So that kind of flips that. And I think that kind of flips that tool on its head from the perspective of our special education directors. I think the other concern is using that FBA, it may not be the best for each child in every circumstance. It sort of overrides the local decision-making process of the special education directors or the teachers. If they believe something else like a staff safety plan or response to intervention or positive behavior supports might be a better way of doing that, or some of the new cutting-edge trauma-informed practices might be better than doing a functional behavior analysis mm-hmm. to immediately address that. There's some concerns that you still now are required statutorily if a staff member's injured. So again, reactive, not proactive, not preventative. So that's a concern for us. And I think, again, it's hard to be up here on these types of things because I don't disagree, and I respect Soren greatly, and she's listened to our concerns, and I've been probably a pain more than I need to be on this bill with her. But it ultimately comes from a place of concern from our special education directors and the other folks that deal with these people, which is even if you have a very narrowly crafted mandate, we have we're not addressing the real problem, which is we don't have enough trained people and we don't have the resources. You know, there's dozens of openings across the state for all kinds of special education related positions in our school districts, and we're having trouble finding qualified people. So even a very narrowly crafted mandate or requirement that is well-intentioned and that we agree with what it's trying to prevent and what it's trying to do just saps that much more resource from the very limited resources we have, and especially when it's kind of written as no exceptions, when you're sort of substituting the judgment of a special education director or a school psychologist or a special education teacher for a one-size-fits-all FBA, which again is a tool about making sure students have access to the classroom. It's not created with the intent of dealing with injuries after the fact. So, again, you know, it's not always fun to get up here and talk about these things, but I appreciate you listening to our thoughts on the bill. Thank you.
Yes. Senator Gelsler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, at the beginning, I said I haven't said this very often, but there is someone I've said that about in a hearing before, and that would be Morgan Allen, who's also a really great person to work with, even when we're on kind of see issues in different ways. So thank you for your work on this. I know you're always just a really great collaborator. The question I have is that I appreciate the framing of what's the frame of the analysis. Is it a staff injury or a student need? But if a student's behavior has escalated to the point that they're injuring staff, isn't that likely to lead to some sort of a disciplinary action or a placement change that would impact their doesn't it become kind of the same?
I think it does, and again, and as you know, Senator, I'm not an expert on this, but what our folks are telling me that generally the requirement for a functional behavior analysis right now is if the student misses 10 or I believe it's 10 or more days due to discipline or other issues related to behavior, and so the functional behavior assessment is designed to get the kid back on track, remove obstacles, and help ensure that the supports are there to encourage behavior that allows them to stay in school. So that's, you know, maybe that's not the best description, but that's kind of how I, as a layperson, am processing that. We're flipping that from it's about making sure the student has access to the education program to sort of reactively doing this if a staff person is injured, when there's other tools that are at our folks' disposal to deal with that quicker. We still have to go through this process, and it's kind of more paperwork that it's really comes from that vein.
And then a follow-up, yep. Please. I mean, I think one of the challenges that's in here, and people have said it's not a silver bullet, and, you know, we've got hard to find people that can do these things, and we have real workforce and resource challenges. But I tend to believe that if we were really to look at the challenge of behavior in schools, which is significant and not just a special ed issue, and we were able to go back to the beginning and look at what is it that's driving the behavior. When you mentioned the trauma-informed care, the whole idea behind trauma-informed care, whether it's a kid in special education or not in special education or an adult that has behavioral issues in a residential setting, it's really doing some sort of an assessment to understand what is it that drives the behavior, triggers the behavior, what's the need that's being expressed through that behavior. So I wonder if there's a flaw in when we trigger that maybe we would want to help a student be more successful and not interfere with you know, just having the circumstances around that not create a burden for staff and kids before you've reached the point that you're out of school for 10 days. I think that the other point, and I really appreciate it, I think it was Jared that mentioned it's not just a special ed issue. I know what I've heard from, you know, one of my districts that's really talked a lot about behavior, and we heard today about older kids, but a lot of kindergarten, first, second graders that may or may not be in special education that are totally blowing out and really trying to figure out what is it that's going on with these little kids. And there's a part of me that wonders if we could really get in there and look at functional behavior, collaborative problem solving, some of these other issues, could we learn things that move across all kids so that we're not clearing first grade classrooms because Sue, who's not in special education, is throwing a chair, throwing a pair of scissors at someone, or cutting off somebody's braid. There's got to be a reason in our society that these behaviors are increasing, and it's not disability related, probably trauma-informed care related. It's creating a lot of issues for everyone, not least of which the children for whom something is going on. And so I just appreciate the idea behind this, that we're trying to get to the root of what the behavior is rather than respond to it through a change in placement, because then you're just going to move that behavior to a different placement where you've now got five kids in a room who are throwing chairs and you haven't gotten to, you know, why are you throwing a chair, and you haven't addressed the education needs of the kid.
Okay. Good question. Without a question, but
right. It was just more. Sorry.
Nope. Okay. Thank you, Morgan. With that, we're going to close the public hearing on 3318. We will be revisiting. Most of these will be put forward to work sessions or possible work sessions with more hearings as we get more information. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3423. We'll have a short explanation, and Representative Esquel, who's been in and out, trying to get. Figure out what time to be here. So thank you for staying with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6.
Sal, and
I will wait for you to read the bill.
She was going to explain first. That we
That's
wait
what I said. I will wait for her to read the bill.
Very good. Thank you, Sal.
Been there, done that.
Chair
he catches on quick.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3423 exempts Oregon National Guard members who have completed initial active duty training from the requirement to enroll in community college courses within 6 months of attaining their previous highest level of education in order to qualify for the Oregon Promise Grant. The bill clarifies that in order to qualify for a grant, a member must enroll in community college courses within 6 months of completing initial active duty training as evidenced by the U.S. Department of Defense.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and senators, this is a pretty simple bill. It really is. It allows our National Guard to have some extra time before they have to, they can be eligible for that grant. Because the way it is now, if you leave and go into training, you could go 3.5 months to a year training and lose out on this grant, even though you're part of the National Guard. And we don't feel that that's fair. So that's what this is. It exempts them from that. And that's it in a nutshell. Any questions?
Any questions?
Simple, simple.
I think it was a surprise to people to find out that if they thought they were going to go into community college and then they ended up going in the service, that they weren't eligible when they got back out. And it doesn't happen to all of them, because sometimes they can do that over the summer and they can be ready to go the following
year. And
year.
God only knows that those people deserve to be able to go.
Yes.
There's lots of little things that we need to do to that Oregon Promise, and this is one of them. Future Farmers is another one. There's about five. But as we go on, there will continue to be those. And every time we add one person on, it raises the bill. So I'm totally fine with doing this, but I just want us to be cognizant that every time we make these changes from our absolute no-frills programs we started with, that the cost, it just needs to be funded.
Mr. Chair, Senator Haas, I think that these people were eligible. Example, if you went to and trained between your junior and your senior year in school, you would be able to comply with this and be eligible for the grant. This is for the people that go into the service right after school. And it's something that's kind of unforeseen circumstances that we're just unaware of.
If, Mr. Chair, it were up to me, I would grant this to them even if they're after the deadline. But
yeah, well,
we just need to draw a line. So all I'm saying is I need you to vote yes on that budget. When
oh, I see.
The reality is, as we have looked, we had put aside $10 million for the Promise Grant. It turned out that more people with the restrictions on it than we had anticipated showed up, and that bill went over by about $1.6 million or something like that. And we've had to backfill that. And I guess what I think you're hearing is that there have to be limits someplace. So it's right now it's a 2.5, and there's a whole lot of people who believe that it should be less than that, because you want to give those kids that have turned their lives around a chance to be there. I would say we all agree with that.
Sure.
The issue is, at the end of the day, how much can we afford for this program? Even though it brings more money in because we get more money from the federal government, we still have an issue. And so that's going to be an ongoing question. But
well, Mr. Chair, I leave that up to Senator Haas. That's kind of his bailiwick. So the responsibility is his, and I do now leave it to him.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Any
other questions?
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yep. With that, there was no one else that was signed up, so we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill, what is that one? 3423. Okay, and we have another legislator who's shown up, so we'll get back to our other, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3170. We'll start with Senator Denver. We'll have a short explanation. So opening 3170.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3170 extends collective bargaining rights to certain public university faculty members whose duties have an academic rather than an administrative focus. The bill applies to bargaining units certified or recognized on or after the effective date. Applies to agreements entered into on or after the effective date.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, Vice Chair Linthicum, members. I'm Michael Denver. I represent District 23. Northeast and Southeast Portland. And House Bill 3170 has to do with collective bargaining rights for university faculty. As you know, we have collective bargaining for faculty and in K-12, in our community colleges, and in our universities. In the K-12 and community colleges, the line between faculty and supervisors slash managers is pretty clear. You're one or the other. In the universities, it's a little more ambiguous. So a university president is generally a member of the faculty. The provost, generally a member of the faculty. And, you know, clearly they would be exempt from being part of the collective bargaining process as being part of a unit. But we have some faculty who are in a kind of ambiguous position. They're researchers who are coordinating research projects that involves other employees. And currently, under the interpretation of the Public Collective Bargaining Act, they are unable to be part of a bargaining unit. So what House Bill 3170 does is it clarifies that those individuals, such as, you know, the president, the provost, et cetera, despite being faculty, are not, you know, cannot be part of a bargaining unit. But those faculty who are not, you know, of those listed groups could can be. And that's really simply what it does. And we have faculty at our universities, you know, some are able to be part of the faculty union, others are not. This would clarify that those, even though they're research faculty who are leading teams of researchers, can still be part of the bargaining unit. Now, since the bill came over to this side, Oregon State University developed some problems with it, and so we have been meeting, and I think we have resolved those and should be able to have some amendments that will resolve that difference. But they'll speak to them. What we need to clarify is that we don't intend for faculty who are supervising other full-time faculty as part of the unit. Those are not intended to be part of the bargaining unit. We don't want bargaining unit members supervising other bargaining unit members. That becomes very, it raises all sorts of problems. So this clarifies that. And also, I want to clarify that, you know, the bill talks about that this only applies to future bargaining units. And so what that means, and this may also be something that where we may be tightening up in the amendments, that those who this for faculty who would fall into this category, they don't automatically become part of a bargaining unit with the passage of this. They'd still have to go through a unit certification process, a unit clarification process. So that's it in a nutshell. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I think there are a couple of people who will be talking, you know, from the front lines of this issue, and then a couple of people from Oregon State.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We'll bring up Jason Whalen, Chris Sinclair, and Donna Chastain. And that should be... Mm-hmm. Whoever wants to start.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Chris Sinclair, and I am here today to speak in favor of House Bill 3170. I am president-elect of the Faculty Senate at the University of Oregon and an associate professor of mathematics. My research involves random matrix theory, mathematical statistical physics, and the distribution of algebraic numbers. I joined the University of Oregon in 2009, and I love my work, my students, and the university. I see the University of Oregon as an economic driver for the region, and I am very proud to work there. As a faculty member, I am fortunate enough to be able to have the choice of whether or not I want to join a union. This is the same option that thousands of university faculty around the state already have. I see our union as a mechanism by which faculty can help steer the university in the direction of sustained academic excellence, and I believe that all of my colleagues at the University of Oregon and on other campuses around the state should have that same opportunity. Unfortunately, because of the current supervisor exclusion language and the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act, some of my colleagues at the University of Oregon and at other public universities around the state don't have the same choice, despite the fact that they have similar academic research, teaching, and outreach responsibilities. The result is a confusing and inefficient system of determining who should and shouldn't be able to collectively bargain. I've witnessed this firsthand. Currently, we still have to undergo a very complicated process with the university every single term to identify who is moving in and out of the bargaining unit. This bill is a simple fix to that problem. As faculty, we perform a complex job that does not always fit neatly into a 1940s private sector labor law definition, especially not when we are talking about faculty who perform cutting-edge research. Like nursing or firefighting, faculty at Oregon's public institutions perform complex work for the public good, and it's important to note that nurses and firefighters already have a similar exemption in place. HB 3170 would put public university faculty around the state on equal footing. I take pride in my work, in my union, and in my university, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to have a shared voice in shaping our academic excellence. I urge you to support HB 3170 so that my colleagues around the state can have the same option. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You have the microphone. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here to speak on what I believe to be an important issue. My name is Jason Wyan. I'm a partner with Tedesco Law Group. My firm represents labor unions in the state of Oregon, including several university bargaining units. I'm here in support of 3170, which seeks a limited amendment to the statute that defines which public employees are supervisors under the PECPA and therefore are excluded from the ability to engage in collective bargaining with their employer. The amendment sought would provide a simple clarification that public university faculty are generally not supervisors, but does make it clear that the other administrative types that are listed in the statute as well are still excluded from the ability to bargain. Before, and by way of background, a supervisory employee is currently defined, and as it was said earlier, this is from the 1940s in the private sector, and so it doesn't exactly fit well under the current rubric. But it's defined as someone who has the authority in the interest of the employer to hire, transfer, suspend, lay off, recall, promote, discharge, assign, reward or discipline other employees, or responsibly direct them, or to adjust their grievances, or to effectively recommend such action. So it is a mouthful, no matter how you look at it. And before joining the Tedesco Law Group, I was a member of the Oregon Employment Relations Board, the state agency that was tasked with deciding who is and is not a supervisor in these contexts. And I can tell you from personal experience, both as an advocate and as a neutral decision maker, that these cases, when it comes to a dispute of who is supervisory, is a very time-consuming, extensive process. You have to look at each one of those individual criteria for each particular employee. And so if there's large disputes at the university level about, you know, how many of these folks are supervisory and are not under those old-fashioned criteria, it's going to require lots of days of hearing, lots of witnesses. Lots of lawyers usually represent the parties on both sides, and we don't think that that's an efficient use of limited resources. So we believe that House Bill 3170 would simplify this substantially and save both parties, both sides of the equation, a lot of time and energy. And one of the reasons this is so problematic in the academic world is the nature of the so-called supervisory duties that these folks perform. Unlike traditional supervisors, professors' focus is primarily on teaching and research. They're not engaged in the day-to-day business of supervising. That's not why they're there. In this professional capacity, we just don't believe that those initial supervisory criteria are really well-suited. And again, as it was mentioned by my colleague here, that there are a number of people who move in and out of bargaining units. and can change supervisory status based on what the status of a grant is. And that creates something of a yo-yo effect on whether or not an employee has the right to engage in collective bargaining. That does nothing to promote stable labor relations, nor is it a wise use of limited resources. And I would note again that the legislature has made similar clarifications and exceptions for employees in the firefighting services as well as for nurses. And that we would argue that this is an appropriate place to extend similar exceptions to the current rule.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, first of all, I'm Donna Chastain, Interim Chief Human Resources Officer at Oregon State University. I would like to thank Senator Dembrough for once, as soon as he learned that OSU had concerns, he did meet with us and we are looking at revisions. And I also want to state that OSU does recognize and support the rights of our employees to organize and have union representation. In fact, OSU has two unions on campus with positive and collaborative relationships. One is SEIU with our classified employees, and the other is CGE with our graduate assistants. But I am here today in opposition of House Bill 3170 as it is currently written. And mainly our concern, I wanted to clarify, because it seemed to be some misunderstandings about the role of our research and academic faculty and the role they play in the supervision of their team members. Their team members may include other academic faculty, professional faculty, postdoctoral scholars, research associates, graduate assistants, and undergraduate students. OSU, as an international research enterprise, is also Oregon's land-grant university, and one of two U.S. universities to also hold the Sea Grant, Space Grant, and Sun Grant designations. Our researchers are a primary financial support of the people and property of OSU. Researchers submit proposals that determine the support and infrastructure of their research projects and determine the number and type of employees that they will need to work on their research projects. The supervisory, confidential, and management decisions of these researchers have significant university-wide impact. Many of the academic and research faculty complete the full range of the PECBA duties with the authority to use independent judgment that require acting on behalf of the employer first, including performing confidential management and supervisory duties. Some of these include the managerial duties consisting of the authority to formulate and carry out management decisions or represent management's interests by taking or effectively recommending discretionary actions that control or implement the employer's policies, and who also have discretion in the performance of these management responsibilities beyond the routine discharge of their duties. We also, on the confidentiality side of the duties, we do have representation on our bargaining team in sessions. They provide suggestions and recommendations for contract proposals. On the supervisory roles, they do actively supervise their employees. They are in charge of the hiring and firing, deciding what type of employees they need. They plan and assign their work. They approve their time off, authorize overtime, establish performance goals. If there's problems in the performance, they assist in the performance plan of those employees. And evaluations and discipline up to and including dismissal. Further, our academic and research faculty that supervise must maintain without conflict relating to personnel confidential information of their employees. Divided loyalties and obligations may be created, when allowing the supervisors and employees to be of the same union. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this group? Seeing none, I look forward to looking at the agreements that people are working out, and I was pleased to hear that the ongoing conversations. So we will post this for a work session. If you need more time, we can move it to after that, but we will make sure that we have time to get to the places where everybody thinks they can go. So. Thank you for the work you've been doing. Thanks for all of your work.
Thank you, Chair Logan. Thank you.
So with that, we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 3170. We have already opened House Bill 2701, so it's still open, and we will call up Kai, Nancy Hungerford, Kyle Thomas. We can have all of you together, so we'll have a... You guys can get started, and then we'll come. Okay?
You ready?
Thank you for being here. Yes.
Thank you.
We are ready.
Senator Roblin, Chair, and Senators on the committee. I'm Nancy Hungerford. I'm representing Kai, who is the owner and operator of Abdiel Career College, and I'm going to let her speak mostly. You heard from three representatives who have been very much supporting the efforts that we've made to provide for the opportunity for some due process for these private career colleges that do not give degrees. And those private career colleges or private colleges that do give degrees, they have this protection. They have the right to a hearing. In the case of the private career colleges, they do not have a right to a hearing before probation or some other adverse action is taken, unless it's a suspension or revocation. So these actions, and I've responded to your email earlier today, and I laid out the various implications. So I think all I really need to say at this point is that we urge that you adopt the -5 amendments because they provide for the hearing. And any other amendments that do not clearly provide for the right for a hearing are not going to solve the essential problem, which is the lack of due process. And I would just echo Representative Bynum's statements about the fact that these are small business people. There are 200 or so of these private career colleges in the state that are do not award degrees. And they all are largely small businesses. And a lot of times their life work is tied up in that business. And whereas it may be seeming that being placed on probation or some other corrective action is a minor thing, it is not in terms of what it does to their – it jeopardizes their accreditation. It jeopardizes their ability to have their students get federal loans for student loans. It jeopardizes their reputation in the community and their ability to attract students. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to ask Kai to just add to that. In short, we would urge that you adopt the -5 amendment and that we were supposed to remind you also to post it for a work session. That's what our representatives told us.
It doesn't work well if we don't. Yeah. So
my name is Kai. I'm the owner-director of Abdiel Career College in Medford, Oregon. It was an experience that I had with the HEC that brought to light the concern over not having the right to request a hearing or have evidence from our side heard. And then I subsequently became aware of many other schools who contacted me to let me know their same experiences. Some of them I consider even maybe worse than what happened to my school. So it came to light that I originally sent a letter to the HEC over some bills that are some proposed legislative things they were going to submit. And because I had previously been an advisor on their advisory board when it was called the Department of Education for post-secondary schools, I thought maybe my opinion about some of those proposed changes to the rules they were going to make might be helpful to them. So I initially wrote a letter outlining each of the proposed rules that I had seen and cautioning them about how it may affect the HEC adversely and also private career schools. That, I guess, was taken as a challenge to certain people at the HEC. And within a few weeks of me writing that letter, I found myself under investigation by the HEC. And it was all over, supposedly over a girl who I had spent 3 weeks trying to work with her about an issue with not complying with dress code. And from there, it just escalated. Heck showed up at my school, demanded that I turn off my security cameras. When I couldn't get somebody to come in and do that fast enough, the fellow disconnected them himself. And I was terrified I wouldn't be able to figure out how to get them hooked back up. I asked questions about what I was accused of or being investigated about. I was told I didn't have a right to know. Each time I tried to ask questions, I was told I was not to ask questions. They would not be answering my questions. I was to answer their questions. Public records request revealed that members of the HEC contacted members of my school, students, gave them directions on what to say, what to do, how to do it, what the laws were, reminded them constantly not to let me know that they were communicating with those folks until because they wanted to surprise confront me. And we have evidence of that, and that's how I knew. Everything that was happening at the time with my school, I had no idea what was happening until I watched the news in the evening, because HEC was putting out press releases to the local TV station in our area. And I have documentation of that that confirms that they did that. And it was done on a weekly basis. So my school was being put out on the news and being under investigation, and things were being leaked. And I had no idea until I watched the news what those things were. Or students were being told what to put on Facebook, and so they did a campaign on Facebook to defame my school, my enrollments dropped. All of those things happened to me. So I'm living proof to tell you that's what I experienced, and yet are there other schools in Oregon that are non-degree granting schools that have experienced the same thing? What it did is when I requested a hearing so that I could find out what I was being accused of, I was told I had no right to a hearing. After the HEC placed my school on probation, I requested a hearing again so I could appeal their decision, and I was told again, private career schools do not have the right to request a hearing. What their decision was is what I had to deal with. That's when I became aware that there was a problem with our system. Oregon's degree-granting schools are allowed to request a hearing. If the HEC says they're investigating them and there's an issue, Oregon degree-granting schools can request a hearing before the HEC takes an action against them. Oregon's non-degree-granting schools do not have that right. We don't have a right either beforehand to know what we're being accused of or to present evidence on our side, and we don't have that right to request a hearing after the HEC has issued a decision. And as the representatives testified to you earlier, all actions, whether you want to call it, the HEC wants to call it probation or notice of corrective action, it does not matter what the action is. If the HEC takes an action against a private career school, either degree granting or non-degree granting, that action triggers an investigative process through every other regulatory agency the school has to remain in compliance with. So they can call it what they want. They put in an amendment to change the word probation to notice of corrective action. That's okay. They can call it what they would like to call it, but it doesn't matter what it's called. An official action by the HEC against a school will trigger all other regulatory agencies to do their own investigation. In my case, all of the other regulatory agencies who investigated my school because of the action HEC took found my school to be in compliance and a school of excellence. We've been issued 2 school of excellence awards, and those school of excellence awards still remain. The only agency that found fault with my school from their investigative action was HEC forced me, under threat of revoking my school license, to change a policy in my attendance and externship. They told me if I did not change it to what they wanted it to be, they would revoke my school license. I had no choice but to make those changes, and I told them if I changed them, it would put me in violation of federal regulations. And I was told they didn't care, and they were tired of hearing me whine about it and to make those changes. So in order to keep my school license, I had to make those changes, and I did. And then FAME, the agency that oversees regulations for the U.S. Department of Education, asked me why on earth I changed my policies to go out of compliance when we had a historic record of being in compliance. And I had to tell them because the HEC forced me to do so under threat of losing my school license. Mm-hmm. All those things happen, but the real issue here is that at no point did I or any other school that's had an issue or concern with the HEC have we ever been provided the opportunity to provide evidence on our own behalf and to request a hearing, a simple, basic right to say, can we have somebody please look at the facts of these cases? Just look at the facts and make a determination, a fair and unbiased determination based on those facts. And that's why we submitted House Bill 2701. That's why we said we recognize there's a problem. And we thought of a solution to help solve that problem and presented it to the very people, representatives, and to you senators, who we know have the collective wisdom to help us get that accomplished. So that if it's needed in the future and somebody needs to request a hearing, we can do so.
Okay, any questions for these two? Because we'll have HEC. Okay. And Kai, for the record, all we need is Kai, or do you have a last name to go
with?
That's
my full legal name.
Okay, that's good. I just
sorry, it's a Native American.
First time, you know. Yeah,
I know. I get asked all the time.
Thank you. And I think what we're going to do, because I have one more hearing, you've heard the complaints, HEC, and I guess what we'll do, we will post this for a public hearing and possible work session, so we'll get that going. And we'll come back and get some more testimony from you about this in the future. So I would hope you'd be ready to answer some of the concerns that came up, and just wanted to make sure that we got this going and this part. So mm-hmm. Thank you. And so you should be looking for that to happen in the next couple weeks.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both. And Kyle will bring you back at the
Kyle,
later time.
Nice
so
to
thank
meet you.
Okay.
If I spoke
with that,
on the record, I'd have to say my name.
With that, we're going to close our public hearing on 2701. And the patience of Representative Johnson. We're going.
He asked to go last.
And we appreciate that he asked to go last. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3351. There's not a lot of people that want to talk, so that's good. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Mark Johnson from House District 52. Thanks for having us present this bill to you today. I've been involved over the past couple sessions working on some issues related to the Teacher Standards Practices Commission, and I see Senator Cruz smiling at that, and which indicates you have some knowledge of some of the trials and travails that we've had regarding the agency and so forth over the few sessions. You'll remember that a couple sessions ago we had the Secretary of State, in fact, do an audit of them, which shed light on a lot of issues, I think, and some practical means that they could help to provide more expeditious service to the educators that they rely upon. So this bill is kind of an extension of that work. I think it helps to fill in some of the gaps that have been missing, and I think will help them, I think, streamline their ability to serve the teachers and educators that they do work with. And you know that TSBC is in charge of educator licensure and discipline issues. They also have oversight over teacher prep programs in Oregon, which is also a very important function. So this is really a fairly simple bill. And the first section 2, we talk about how the executive director of TSPC shall prepare an annual report that's related to reporting back on our teacher prep programs in some specific areas. And this idea is one that we worked on because of I attended a couple of conferences last summer. And some states are doing some really extensive work in this area. I'll refer to one, I believe it's the state of Kentucky, that actually provides a really detailed dashboard, if you will, to where you can look at any teacher candidate that's in a teacher program, look at what school they're actually in, follow them on where they're placed. You can follow them on how they persist when they're placed in a school. You can actually follow the outcomes of the students that they teach and serve. It's very detailed. We're not suggesting that. But this is just simply in this annual report that TSBC shall give to the legislature. Report on the number of licensures and teaching licenses and administrative licenses that have been issued. Trends related to the number and types of licenses, too. What's changing out there in the marketplace regarding the needs for teacher licensure? Summary of the various activities regarding teacher prep programs, regarding changes for requirements of standards and so forth. A summary of placement of students. Where are we placing students in schools? How are we doing on actually placing those students and so forth? So it's just strictly a reporting mechanism. And again, I think you would all agree that our teacher prep programs are extremely important as we prepare the educators of tomorrow. And are we preparing them in a way for success? And we hear sometimes from teachers that, you know, we get stuck in situations that we haven't been prepared for, especially as we get into some overcrowded classrooms. And I think we all would agree that the type of students that you find in our schools today are more needy than we have in the past as well. So how are we doing at preparing? So that's section two. Section 3 deals with an entirely different issue, and it's related to the discipline work that TSBC has to do. Right now, it's really easy for virtually anyone at a local district level to file a complaint against an educator and have that report, that complaint, go directly to TSBC. And it could be something significant, which if they are, of course, we want those things to be investigated. But it could also be something as simple as my kid wasn't getting played enough in soccer, in this last soccer game or something. But the point is TSBC has to treat all of these things equally. And that educator can have this mark against them until that is resolved. So what this bill does is simply says that prior to beginning an investigation based on a complaint filed under the paragraph A above, the commission may require verification that attempts have been made to resolve the complaint through a complaint process at the local school district first. So if TSBC can simply say, have you run through your local channels? Have you talked to your building principal? Have you talked to your superintendent? Have you talked to your school board? And if not, go do that first, and then we'll hear it. So this is really a popular component regarding the folks at TSBC trying to take some of the, I'll just say, frivolous type of complaints off their plate so they can focus on a lot of the more serious issues that they really have to delve into. So that in a nutshell is what it's all about, Mr. Chair, and with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Yes.
I knew if we waited long enough, he'd come up with an actual good bill. It just took a few years. But
I was surprised this didn't have a large fiscal.
Yeah. I especially, Ms. Chair, like,
obviously they were being nice to you. I don't understand why they didn't say it was going to cost about $3 million. Okay, I would say that kind of stuff in the past.
I would suggest the last portion of that bill is going to save them money.
Because it's going
to allow them to focus on the job they should have, not chasing ghosts. So.
And Senator Cruz, you're right, and we actually heard from some of the employees there who work with the new director, who's terrific, by the way, if you haven't had a chance to talk with her yet. Yeah, she's doing a fabulous job. We heard that they're a very popular bill amongst the folks that actually, you know, have to receive these complaints. So,
We didn't get that on here. It was neutral.
Well, okay. You know how agencies are, Mr. Chair.
So any other questions for Representative Johnson? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So Monica Bean and Trent Danowski, I don't know if I get that right. You can both come up if you want. So all of this extra work and it's not costing any money. I don't understand that, actually.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Monica Bean, Executive Director of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Thank you for the question regarding the fiscal. The fiscal impact to the agency is really minimal, just in the preparation of the report. Most of the data that are included in the report are data that we already collect and gather and report to either the Title II or to any other entity. The third part of the bill is
is very important to the agency. While it will not necessarily be a cost savings to the agency, it will certainly help us to further meet or more easily meet our key performance measures, our KPMs, regarding the case investigation link. And I just wanted to make sure that we are neutral to the bill as an agency director, but I do appreciate the willingness of Representative Johnson and his staff to really engage in conversation with Trent and I in the fall about what are some needs that the agency has, and certainly our team working in the investigative side of things are in favor of this, because it will seriously allow them to focus in on those threats to student safety. And then that's all that I would like to say. And then Trent actually is the deputy director, works specifically with the professional practices, and I'd just like for him to give some information so you have a number before you of how that third portion of the bill would impact the agency.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trent Donowski, deputy director, TSPC. And I just want to offer some information from 2016 regarding professional practices cases for your consideration. In 2016, TSPC recorded 121 patron complaints that came into the agency. There is evidence to suggest, and I apologize for not having the exact number, but there is evidence to suggest that over 75% of those complaints were dismissed by the commission. The other thing that I would like to add to this and just emphasize with this bill language is that this does not in any way compromise our agency's responsibility to protect children in schools and to complete that aspect of our responsibility. We still have full capacity to investigate the complaints that come in if they're severe, and it does not compromise student safety whatsoever.
Mr. Chair, I would also point out that if the first call is at the school level, the chance of getting a quicker solution and one that everybody is happier with is going to be there too. You know, you race it to this level and it takes on a different flavor than just folks at the local level talking and figuring things out. So
any other questions or comments? Sarah, Alma,
anything? Do you want me to make one up?
No. So, I actually do agree that it would be nice to, with 75% of them being already through the process, not resulting in the work being, well, the work is all done, but they're not having received an affirmative issue with respect to the concern.
Well, Ms. Chair, I'd also say, these are not founded. They've had to do the investigation.
Right, exactly.
And it may, and it's still probably unresolved at the local level,
right,
because the investigation is going on here. If it's being taken care of there first,
right,
everybody's happier a lot quicker than having to jump through all the hoops. So I think this is a really, really very positive move.
And no problems with what Representative Johnson is asking for with respect to privacy of teachers or anything, because it's a report that's basically on the numbers, not on the individuals? Or is there a problem with any of that?
Senator Chair Roblin, thank you for the question. No, the information that we will be providing will be aggregate data. It will not be personally identifiable data. The system that he referenced in Kentucky, we're very familiar with that in our experience in West Virginia, and we had a very similar system in place there. We are not anywhere close to having that level of data in this state. We do have plans to get to somewhat of being able to make those connections because of the national accreditation requirement that our educator preparation programs are required to be nationally accredited by CAPE, and that is a standard that CAPE requires, is that they track their completers and their students, their completer students, K-12 students, success on those summative assessments as well. So that is a standard that they have to meet, but we are working with the educator prep programs with the other bill, Senate Bill 221, which has had a third reading today, that will help to build that data system. But we're not close to that.
Okay. Anything he can do to get away from a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, Matt Johnson? With that, thank you very much for being here, and again, thanks for the work you're doing for the state of Oregon. It is appreciated. With that, we're going to close our public hearing on 3351. We were going to have a informational hearing on House Bill 2998, and that one has to do. Do you want to just okay? We will do that later. We're going to set it another time.
Well, I can't do it in 2 minutes,
yeah.
Can you? Okay.
And he's got some, but it's a bill that went to Ways and Means that I think the rest of us need to know about as we move forward.
Okay.
So, thank you for that very much. And we're going to, unless there's anything else to come before the committee, seeing nothing, we're going to close our. Oh, I could mention that next Thursday we will not be having a meeting. Then we will be having a work group that's been working on some things on that same time. So with that, we're going to close the Senate Education Committee May 18th. Thank you all for being here. And Education Committee May 18th. Thank you all.